Hello, nursing station.
Calling all oncology nurses.
Are you ready to sharpen your practice, maximize your impact, and stay on the cutting edge of oncology care?
Then you found the right place. Welcome to Onc Nurse On Call. We're your hosts, Patricia Jekyll
and Stephanie DeRogier. Join us on the new podcast by Oncology Nursing News as we deliver maximum value in minimal time.
Every minute counts. Let's make it count for your patients.
Hi, we are interviewing today Melinda Mayorga. She is currently a clinical nurse specialist at USC here in Los Angeles, California. Melinda, we're so happy to have you on our podcast today. And I'll start with my first question for you. Can you share how long you've been an advanced practice nurse and describe the pathway that's led to your specialty in oncology?
Sure. Well, first, thank you for having me. What an honor it is to be with some giants in outpatient oncology care. So thank you. So I've been an advanced practice nurse for over 5 years, and I started in the mid-80s as an oncology head nurse and was introduced to the oncology CNS role when one was placed on my unit. And I always really admired the work and effect that she had on nurses and nursing practice and what she was doing at the systems level and how she interacted with our patients. And I thought, that's what I want to do. It took me many years, but so when the last of my four children could drive, I started graduate school and obtained my CNS. And oncology is where I started. When I was a brand new nurse, I was placed on a unit at Stanford that had an oncology hemonc service, a neurology service, and a med-surg service all on one floor. And I loved the oncology patients. And so each next position that I had, the oncology portion of that first job was what allowed me more opportunities as I progressed in my roles. So from that new grad position, I went to be an IV infusionist in New Jersey. And because I'd given chemo in California, I was a part of this specialized team giving chemo throughout a hospital. When I came back to California, I became an assistant nurse manager, then a head nurse, and then a bone marrow transplant coordinator. And then that led me to the ER. And then I came back to oncology. So here I am today and loving it still.
Wow, that's a very impressive resume. So it really just goes to show that once you're in oncology, even if you detour along the way, there's something to be said about oncology nurses from bedside to even advanced practice nurses. It really is a calling. Really is a calling.
And it truly is, because oncology has changed so much. And I've loved seeing that evolution in the various roles that I've had. And it's cancer care is still so fascinating and fulfilling for me. So you're right. It is a calling.
I agree. So that leads me to my second question. When you think about your career as a clinical nurse specialist, and I'm sure you could name so many things you've had impact in, whether it's clinical practice, education, policies, looking at performance improvement, what would you say has been the most impactful for you?
Well, I think that I have been very interested in involving myself wherever an ambulatory oncology patient goes. So that means our patients start at valet, they head to registration, they could go to IR or rad onc, or they could have a clinic appointments or infusion appointments. And all of those journeys, oncology patients have needs. And so I've really tried to understand what's happening in those clinical practice areas from the walk to the nursing practice. And so I believe one of the great initiatives that I've done here is fall prevention, and not just in the clinics and in our day hospital, but really developing a culture of fall prevention that begins with our valet and extends to when they're asking questions of our patient experience. I've spent time with each of those teams because they all help in the care of our patients. And I've spent time with each of them, educating them about fall prevention, about what if they see something, somebody who's wobbling, who's bended over, who has a walker, all of those things. I'm hoping in their minds they're seeing that patient could be at risk for fall. Is there something that I can do or somebody I can call from behind my desk that can help that patient arrive safely to the next spot? We have wonderful metrics of really so few falls in the last 4 years in both our clinics and our day hospitals. We are well below
Wow.
benchmark levels. And so I'm really extraordinarily happy about that because it's not just the nursing aspect, it's everybody.
Everybody that impacts a patient.
Everybody. Everybody.
Wow, that's amazing. You should be very proud of
Ah,
that.
thank you. I'm always so happy when I see those valet guys using our Staxi wheelchairs correctly because we taught them how to use those and get patients in and out of the car safely. So
Wow, wow.
been
And
a
I
happy.
saw you present that at ONS, so I think
Yes.
next step is a manuscript.
Yes. Yes,
Yes.
I need to. I need to.
And that takes me to my next question. You currently have an article published in the Journal of Palliative Care and Hospice called Last Responders. Talk a little bit about that and where did that originate from?
Yes, thank you. So about 3 years ago, I was up in our ICUs searching for a signature on a paper because we'd had a code blue in our RAD-ONC area. So I was just looking for a signature on the paperwork on that. And when I went up there, I could hear the nurses trying to cobble together a schedule to sit with a patient who was about to be extubated. And I said, well, I can sit with the patient. And so they immediately agreed to that and they told me a little bit about the patient. And so I went in and sat with her and her she didn't her she had family, but the family was not in town, nor were they available. She had had a change of condition and rapid deterioration. So there was no longer any brain activity. So they were going to pull her breathing tubes. And so I offered to sit with her and so I sat with her and I sat with her for 32 minutes. And in those 32 minutes, and this is in the article, I hummed my favorite hymn. I gently spoke to her and I told her that she was grand because I believe every life is grand. It just manifests itself differently. And so, after she was extubated, the heart rate increased, then it decreased, and then there was no more sign of life. And after that, I came downstairs and spoke to our patient experience manager. I said, we need to start some sort of vigil program so none of our patients ever die alone. It turns out that that had been something that had been discussed prior to COVID, and it just never happened. So finally, we were able to have the momentum to bring about By Your Side here at Keck and Norris as part of our volunteer program. And I was involved in policy development and in training. And I'm happy to report that since that started, we've had 64 individuals who've not died alone and feel very, very honored to have been a part of developing that for our hospitals. So when I described that event to my brother, who's in the funeral industry, he said to me, Mel, you and I are last responders. Why don't you write about that? Nobody ever talks about that. And I thought, oh, that's so clever. I've never heard of that term. It's just a really clever term. I sort of had it in the back of my mind. A couple months after that, I was at a conference with Betty Farrell, and I wanted to ask her some advice about my next educational pursuits. And she asked me, what are you truly interested in? And I said, I'm actually truly interested in end of life. I'm not in palliative care right now, but I'm really interested in end of life. And so I told her about this patient that I'd sat with and my brother's, sort of clever comment. And she said, wait, what did you just say? I said, oh, he called us last responders. And she said, can you write an article about that? And I said, sure. I looked in the literature to see if there was any work on last responders. And it turns out there were a few citations that described last responders, and I read those and felt like the definition wasn't broad enough. So I redefined it in this article, and I defined a last responder as a person with or without specialized training who is among the last to attend or to give care to a person who is actively dying or who is deceased or who provides and supervises life's last rite of passage. And so when I did that, it broadened the individuals who are last responders, yet who may not know that. They've never thought of themselves of that way. They've never heard of the term, and they don't realize that there's a sacredness to the work that's done at the end of life. So that's where the term came from. And when I wrote it, it was accepted. Since then, I've developed a presentation which I've delivered to organizations here locally, and I've presented it to another hospital. And it's just been so well received because I include nursing implications in that presentation.
And it's interesting that you describe it as that, because I find that so much focus is on the beginning of life. And even though, in oncology, people often associate it with end of life, just the fact that you took the time to pause to talk about the sacredness of even that transition is powerful.
Thank you. And yes, you absolutely said it correctly. We have a team of people who are devoted to the birth of an individual. Just think about, our various experiences with that. Yet at the end of life, that's different. It's perhaps care that's given in segments. And so it's not this cohesive group of people who are at the end of life, maybe in the hospital, but maybe not. Yet we all have a particular role at the end of life, whether you are an individual who picks up the body at the morgue, you have a role, you are a last responder. Whether you are the funeral director or the restorative cosmetologist, or you are a nurse caring for a baby before the parents come in, or maybe you're a pathologist and you're identifying why this individual died. This is all sacred work because it comes at the end of an individual's life.
I agree. Thank you, Melinda. And I will hand you over to Patty.
Mel, you touched my heart greatly with this presentation, and I'm sure you will touch other people greatly with this presentation. But talk a little bit. Your program is called By Your Side at USC, and
Yes.
it's a team of last responders, basically, and encompassing those patients so a patient doesn't die alone. How
Correct.
did you integrate that into practice? We all need to know that, because as all of us as CNSs know, bringing it into practice is usually the hardest part, to get others to believe in your program and your process.
Well, I think it's first of all is awareness. The term is so new that it's not well understood. Yet when you take the time to explain it, they're like, it's an aha moment, like, oh yeah, I am a last responder. And so integrating the various individuals who provide care is definitely a challenge. What we've done here at Keck, which is to me a part of last responders, is the By Your Side, the vigil program. And we haven't associated necessarily as a last responder, but it is last responder work. Some of the other initiatives that are well within a last responder is we recently developed a sacred pause initiative that encompasses an interdisciplinary approach to just-in-time grief support. It's almost every institution has chaplains and support for individuals who might be grieving. But as I was talking with nurses, it was nurses who first brought the need to me and asking me if we had a prayer of transition because the LVN had just found out very casually that her patient had died. And that's one of the things that we found out is that in outpatient, so many of the notifications come so casually, as a physician is walking by you, oh, by the way, Mr. So and so just died. And you've been taking care of that patient for 2 or 3, 4 years as part of their cancer care, and all of a sudden they're gone, and you know them, they know you, you've shared life's discussions interwoven into assessments. And so when she asked me that, I knew she was grieving. And right after that, another nurse came to me and said, I can't believe my patient just died. I just gave chemotherapy last week and I just found out today that she died. And so I knew we had to do something about this grief that we weren't addressing in the moment. Yes, our nurses knew that they could reach out to our care for the caregiver, or they could call a code lavender. And those things are great and wonderful, and they'd help. I was looking to provide something, gather something for individuals right at their desk while they were waiting for a chaplain. And so I took a look at the literature and developed a toolkit based on what I was finding and involved our chaplain, our mental health professionals, arts and medicine, and involved our plant environment manager. And we developed QR coded prayers that a nurse can just shine her phone on if she wants to hear from our chaplain right away. If you don't want the spiritual aspect, there's another QR code for our psychiatrist who talked about grief and stages of grief, and you can pick among different videos that he prepared. If you don't want to do any of that, you can light a candle. So we provided battery operated candles. If you don't want to do any of that and you want to paint a rock in memory of this patient, we developed a sacred garden for these rocks. And rocks are painting rocks is one of the oldest forms of expression in all cultures and can be found everywhere in
Absolutely.
ancient sites. And so this is something that is not new, but it remains meaningful. Additionally, when I interviewed our restorative cosmetologist and our funeral director, I'd asked them, if you could speak to a group of nurses, what would you want me to say to these nurses? What can I teach them from your perspective? The restorative cosmetologist said, please tell the nurses to remove as much tape as they possibly can. Because as the body begins to change in terms of the integrity and the tissues, that tape becomes problematic. And they asked if we could remove tubes around the lips, because that's a very difficult part of the body to restore. So just communicating that to nurses when I've spoken of that, it's this aha moment of, oh my gosh, I never even thought that what I just did in terms of care is affecting the next stage of this person's end of life journey. And I was told by a person who owns monuments and does monuments that those decisions don't need to be right away. You can take your time. And if a nurse can sort of walk through that with a patient, if it's appropriate, I think that relieves our patients of so many of the emotional responsibilities that are associated with death. If they know that it's okay to wait, it's okay to take the time that you need in order to get through the activities at hand with the death.
Well, don't dive under the desk when I say this part.
Okay.
Please publish some of it now. I mean, this is such amazing information that even a how-to, maybe with your brother or with the person that does the cosmetic work that you
Oh,
talk to,
that's a great
because
idea.
I think that would be a really great publication for nurses. This is important work, and you're doing great work, and I did not know that about end of life and how to prepare the body. We're not taught that. We're just say, okay, put them
No.
in the body bag,
Right.
take out any medical devices, take out needles,
Correct.
and off
Correct.
we send them. And that would have been great information. So bravo, bravo to your
Thank
program in the
you.
outpatient setting. But
That's
I have a quick question.
yes.
As part of our role is sustainability.
Yes.
When you take your finger off the pulse, as I used to always say to Stephanie, when you take your finger off the pulse and you don't overlook it and make sure it's there every day in our controlling fashion, How do you sustain a program like what you're doing in the outpatient setting to help the moral distress that we as healthcare providers experience on a daily basis? And we've done a lot of work in the inpatient setting. Now you're doing this great work in the outpatient setting. How do you keep it going?
That's a really great question, and that was one of the issues of how are we going to sustain this? And that's one of the reasons why we did video recordings that could always be included in these toolkits. We've placed 10 toolkits so far. When I interviewed our nurses, we did find some common themes within those interviews. We also have surveys embedded in that so that people can continue to tell us what was the trigger for your
Okay.
use of the toolkit, and what did you find helpful? So we already have some data. Now it's challenging because when you're in the role of grieving, you don't necessarily want to do a survey. I understand that. So our data might not match the number of rocks we have out there. In the beginning of the year, we will have a team who constantly pre-paint them, and that's part of their role. And that will belong to our Institute of Arts and Medicine. The visual program is self-sustaining because that's all organized and there's calendars and there's retraining every year. It's just continually talking about where their resources are and how important it is, and acknowledging that grief that is not expressed or grief that is held can be detrimental to our health, to our sustainability in our work. And we don't want our nurses to burn out and leave the workforce. We want to be able to address one of the realities of our work. And some of our patients will die, and we've all had those special patients that we remember. And this is one way where we can put all of those connections together and have it live on in the ground where a body may rest finally. And so it's just a whole lovely circle. And I love that I've been able to be a part of this, and that there's been such engagement with the outpatient oncology nurses here at Keck, and for the outstanding institutional support that I have received with all of my ideas. So thank you for letting me share all of what I'm doing.
Well, congratulations to you and to USC, and I thank you for the patients, their families, and the staff that you are supporting. So thank you very much.
Thank you very much. I'm honored.
That's it for this episode of Onc Nurse On Call. You can find the detailed show notes at www.oncnursingnews.com.
If you found value in this episode, hit subscribe wherever you listen to your podcast and leave us a review. It helps other oncology nurses find our show.
Join us again in 2 weeks for another power-packed evidence-based episode.
Until then, keep leading with excellence.